WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. The ABC TV series Equal Justice returns this week. It's a courtroom drama about a big city prosecutor's office. One of the stars is Joe Morton. His best-known film role was in John Sayles' The Brother from Another Planet, in which he played a sensitive extraterrestrial who couldn't speak. But in the films Tap and Trouble in Mind, he played tough-talking, eccentric gangsters. Now on Equal Justice, he's an aggressive prosecuting attorney. Here's Morton in the courtroom giving his summary to the jury.
This is the worst case I've ever tried. I'm sick of it. You see these two gentlemen here? That's my boss. And that is the district attorney. The guy that you vote for. He doesn't want me to say this, but I've got to tell you something. This case is out of control. It's been tried in the streets, it's been tried in the corridors, it's been tried in the evening news, on the steps of this courthouse, but my God, there is only one place this case should be tried, and that is in this courtroom in front of you. Now, how could this happen? How?
Now, I know that the part that you got, the leading part on Equal Justice, wasn't the part that you were supposed to audition for. What part did you come in to read for?
They actually had me come in to read for a reverend who was supposed to be like an Al Sharpton type character. The situation, I don't know if you remember the pilot, was like a Bensonhurst or like a Howard Beach kind of situation. And they had a character, as I say, who was sort of an Al Sharpton. And that's the part that they wanted me to audition for. I actually did end up reading for the part, and in fact, they offered it to me. That is, they called my agent, and they made a money deal and so forth. But in the meantime, I had asked them to let me read a character named Mike Corelli, who was the chief prosecutor. And they did let me read it, but they also made it quite clear that it would probably not be very possible for me to play the role since they didn't think they could, quote-unquote, go black with a role like that. So after the offer was made, I thought, so that was sort of said and done. And then the weekend after they offered me the Al Sharpton role, they actually asked me to come to L.A. to audition for, that is to test in front of the network, for Mike Corelli. Carter Smith and I both ended up auditioning for the same role. Carter plays my boss in the show. He plays the bureau chief, and Rogan. And we both auditioned for Corelli. He read, and then I read, then he read Rogan, then we went in. They had us read together. And that actually sort of cinched it. They liked the two of us together. They really enjoyed the sort of dynamic that takes place between the two of us. And they knew they were going to hire us both, but they weren't sure in which role, whether it would be either Rogan or Corelli. And as it turned out, he got Rogan and I got Corelli, and we're both very happy.
Is it best to be, like, really nice about these things when you want to audition for a role, or is it best to be really aggressive about it?
It's sort of, you know, when you're in business of any sort, you have to sort of find some gray area in between. You have to obviously maintain a certain amount of respect and politeness for the people that you're working with, but at the same time, you have to make it clear and evident to them that you are sincere and earnest about what you're asking, and that it's something that you think you can do a good job in.
Now, the executive producer and director of the program, well, the executive producer of the program who directed the pilot,
Thomas Carter,
yeah, is black himself, and
that's,
I was wondering if he was helpful to you when you wanted to read for the prosecutor.
Well, I don't really know, as I say, what went on behind the scenes after I asked him. I mean, I think he was intrigued by the question. Thomas is a very interesting young man. I mean, he is both artistically inclined as well as commercially savvy. So I think he was put into a position where he had to sort of tread a very fine line. I mean, he certainly could not make it seem as if he wanted to push this idea simply because I was black. And yet at the same time, he was obviously most interested in finding the best actor for that role, which is why I think probably Carter and I ended up auditioning for the same role. He had to think about a couple of things. He had to think about what the pilot was going to do by itself before it had been picked up as a series, and whether it would work for the pilot. And then once he made that decision, he had to think, how is this character going to work all the way down the line in terms of the series? So there was a number of things that he had to think about and consider.
When you got the part of the prosecutor, the name of the role was changed from Mike Carelli to Michael James.
That's right.
Any other changes made in the character?
No, everything else remained the same. And that was the other thing that we all, without speaking about it, agreed on. In other words, once the character went black, we didn't suddenly want him to be, you know, a jazz aficionado and start
instead of opera, right, yeah.
Exactly, which is all fine within mm-hmm. itself, except that what I was trying to do, partly what I was trying to do, was create yet again another alternative for the kind of black people that you might see on the screen. We're used to seeing black men in particular as bad guys or as Al Sharptons or as people in the business world who are fixated on making lots of money and wearing good clothes. And I was looking for an alternative, and this was certainly an alternative, a guy who was involved with the prosecution end of things, who was involved with opera, and who was involved with being an Italian gourmet, all of which is certainly possible in a generic Northeastern setting.
Have you ever done anything else unusual to get a role, ask for parts that weren't specified black and there were therefore assumed to be white?
Well, I spent actually most of my career doing exactly that.
Uh-huh.
The lawyer, again, another lawyer that I played in Good Mother, the Diane Keaton film,
mm-hmm.
I was the only black man who showed up for that part. And when I showed up, Leonard Nimoy and I had a very long conversation about, as he put it, introducing color into his movie. And I literally presented my case, as it were, as if I had been a lawyer. And it was that particular conversation that convinced him that I should be allowed to read. And finally, we sort of became friends and he gave me the part. I think it's something that actors of color and actually even women, actresses, should spend a lot of time doing. I think that we live in a world, and certainly this business, that's based on image. And when someone writes a script or someone's deciding to direct a script or produce a script, they go at it vis-a-vis their image, who they think these people are, what their life experiences has been. And without any malice or forethought, they eliminate a great section of what might be out there. And unless you bring up the idea, I don't think in many cases they would think of it on their own. So I think it's something that actors should do as often as possible. And the reason I say women is there are lots of parts that are lawyers or doctors or whatever who don't have, let's say, a love relationship or, you know, whatever in the script that would nullify that kind of idea. And they can go in and say, you know, I read this part here and there's no reason, for instance, this part could not be played by a woman, or there's no reason this part could not be played by a black or Chicano or an Asian. And you could even stretch it so far as to say that by someone who is of quote-unquote advanced years. I mean, I think it's something that once you bring up the idea, you might in fact get the creative wheels to spin.
Are there stock roles for black actors that you became accustomed to seeing over the years?
Yes. I mean, I stayed away from television just because of that, because it seemed to me on TV, black actors played one of two kinds of roles. They either played buffoons or they played really bad individuals who had no sense of conscience whatsoever. And so that seemed to be the only possibilities. And in film, at that time, I started working this business in 1968. There, not until the 70s, and in the 70s there was mostly black exploitation, there just was nothing in between. I didn't see my particular life experience or the life experience of middle-class individuals who happened to be black on the screen. I didn't see stories about just men and women who met, fell in love, and had children or didn't have children and had whatever problems that they had to work out. All I saw was that black represented either someone who had to fight for proving his equality in the world or was incarcerated, mm-hmm. or was just so silly that he couldn't be taken seriously.
Did you ever audition for any of the blaxploitation films?
Absolutely not.
You didn't want to be part of it?
No.
Actor Joe Morton is my guest. He co-stars in the TV series Equal Justice, which begins its second season this week. He also appeared in the movies Brother from Another Planet, Tap, and Trouble in Mind. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor Joe Morton is my guest. Let me ask you about some of your experiences coming of age. I know you spent your early childhood on army bases in right. Europe. What did your father do?
My father was a captain in the army, and his duty, in fact, was to integrate the armed forces overseas. So that meant we were usually one of two black families on an army post, which in the mid to late 1950s was probably not the most enjoyable circumstances. But at the same time, certainly a great education for both my mother and I.
What kind of education are you talking
about?
Well,
in terms of, I guess, the depth and idiosyncrasies of racism. I mean, I remember a story where I was a kid and I was selling, I don't know if you remember, I don't know how old you are, but there used to be comic books, and at the back of the comic books, you know, you could sell Christmas cards, and then depending on how many number of Christmas cards you sold, you would get a bicycle or whatever it might be, and I used to sell them on the post. And I went to one door, and I knocked on the door, and I was no more than maybe 8. And a young kid came to the door, younger than I was, and said, "Mommy, there's a nigger at the door." And my first response was absolute rage and anger. And my second response was actually that this kid was too young to know what he was talking about. He was simply repeating something that he had heard his parents say. So it was things like that that sort of begin to crystallize in terms of what racism is about. The other side of the coin, of course, is I was in battles with kids on the other side of the neighborhood. That is, the only other black kid and I were in battles with them most all the time. And because of my father's training in the Army, we actually were taught how to hide weapons and move them all around the post, so in case we were in trouble, we could go and protect ourselves.
So you were taught as a child how to hide weapons?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, weapons meaning sticks and garbage can lids and slingshots and broom handles. No, not guns and knives. No, no, no. This was just to keep people away from you, not to kill anybody or hurt anybody unless they were trying to do the same to you.
How often did you have to use it?
Several times. I mean, at least 3 or 4 times a week. I mean, you know, that's the situation you find yourself in. You're living in a very explosive set of circumstances on an army post. Everybody on that post has a weapon in their home. Everybody came to that post knowing what was going on in terms of, found out what was going on in terms of integration. Everybody had real hard feelings about it one way or the other, pro and con. And the children, all of them, found themselves in the middle. Either they were repulsed by it, or they found themselves doing exactly the same thing that their parents might do if they were against the black people, or us black people, being there. The reverse, of course, was just as true. My father died when I was 10, and we came back to the United States, and I literally went from Dachau to Sugar Hill, which is 155th Street and Edgecombe Avenue. And because at the time I could speak fluent Japanese and some German, and because I had no particular regional accent from the South, and because I didn't know how to play basketball, and because I was fairly good in school, I became, as did the brother from another planet, the stranger. And I found myself just as frequently in fights with black kids in that particular neighborhood because I was still sort of the outsider. So racism really comes down to sort of cultural patterns. What I mean by that is if you enter any particular group as the stranger, more than likely you'll be ostracized whether you are the same skin color or not. If you are outside the norm, most people's response is fear and aggression.
I just want to get back to something you said a moment ago. You said you literally went from Dachau to Sugar Hill.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean? Were you stationed right near Dachau?
We were stationed in Dachau, yeah. That was the last place we were stationed before we came back to the States.
In the concentration camp?
Yeah, it had been converted into an army base. And so the dependent buildings were on one side of the fence, and the barracks were on the other side of the fence. And actually, at times when I was a kid, you could, because there is that sort of museum that was left there. You could actually walk into the museum and watch the tours and walk into the showers and open up the doors to the ovens and so forth. And for a kid who was at that time 9 or 10, it was sort of like a house of horrors, as opposed to what you begin to realize as you get older and you understand the depths of what happened there. So yes, we were actually stationed in Dachau. We weren't just sort of near it.
When you moved back to the States, did the knowledge you had about how to hide things you could use as weapons come in handy? Did you
No, because that? The shock of being now in fights with people who were my own race was so overwhelming that it just stayed just that shock. I just couldn't somehow understand or get over the fact that I was now in battles with other black kids because I was different. And so what I ended up doing was my mother realized how difficult my first year was when we came back to the States. And so she found this military school in Newburgh, New York, and asked me did I want to go. And I gave a rousing yes, because it was at least something that I understood on some level. And so I went to military school for 3 years, a Catholic military school, which is sounds like it's redundant, but it's not. And actually it was it was probably the best thing that happened to me. It sort of was a place where I found a great deal of focus. I learned how to be very disciplined and actually began to realize that I had some verbal skills and began to use them. It was also a place to for me to overcompensate like mad, which is what I did. By the time I graduated from that school, I think I was second or third in my class, and major of the school, which is the top-ranking officer of the school, and drum major of the band. So I had a great deal of control, which is what I think I thought I needed at the time.
What got you interested in acting?
Actually, I'd been writing music while I was in high school, and when I entered college as a psychology major, and they sort of trotted us around the university to show us, you know, what the university looked like, and then they took us into the theater to show us skits of what our first year at Hofstra University might be like. And at the end of these skits, everyone left the theater, and I just sat there thinking, you know, I like to sing and I like to write music. Maybe I could be an actor. And I left the theater and walked to the registrar's office and changed all my majors from psychology to drama. And that was it.
Your first breaks were in musicals, but you moved away from musicals.
Well, it was something I never wanted to do. I mean, I'd spent 3 years training as a classical actor, wanting to do Shakespeare and the Greeks and wanting all of that to parlay itself into dramatic roles in film. But when I came into the city in 1968, there were no such roles for black actors, and the only things that were available were things like Jimmy Shine and Big Dime Buck White or musicals. And as it turned out, I auditioned for all of them and ended up in Hair. So that sort of sent me rolling for a while. I did musicals for as long as I thought it did me some good. But to me, it seemed like it was a dead end, unless you wanted to be a song and dance man and use that as sort of the core of who you are as an entertainer. It wouldn't take me very far, and it certainly wouldn't take me to film as someone respected as a dramatic actor. So I left doing musicals and started doing regional theater, started getting back to the things I wanted to do in the first place. My idea was that your first step in any business is to get well known within the community, within the industry itself, and then that sort of brings you to the fore or brings you up to the surface so that the rest of the world can sort of get a glimpse of what you do, and that seemed to work very well. And then after I did that for a while, I began getting auditions in film, and so I started doing small films, and I guess the first big break was Brother from Another Planet.
Did you have any performance fantasies when you were growing up?
Yeah, whenever we came into New York, however briefly, my grandmother always used to take me to the Apollo, and very often it was to see Sammy Davis Jr., in fact, and one of my fantasies was that, you know, he would look out to the audience and say, ladies and gentlemen, there is a young man out here, and that if we give him some applause, he might grace us with a song. And of course, that was me, and I would always in my fantasy go on stage and sing and dance with Sammy Davis Jr. The closest I got to that fantasy, of course, was Tap. I didn't get to sing and dance with him, but at least we were in the same movie together, so it was sort of a dream come true.
That's right. Well, Joe Morton, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joe Morton co-stars in the ABC TV series Equal Justice, which returns this week. This is Fresh Air.